A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time! And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series!
I remember running home from school, turning on the TV to the Cubs game, sitting with my dad to watch his heroes.
Welcome to the World Series Dreaming Chicago Cubs Dreamcast, not affiliated with the actual Chicago Cubs, but just a bunch of guys who love the local nine and enjoy talking baseball and, of course, the 2016 World Series champion Cubs. Hello, welcome, happy new year. This is 2025 and our first show of the new year. And this actually happens to be Dreamcast number 100 by the numerics, but it's probably more than that. We just lost count from the previous iteration of this thing. But yeah, thanks for joining us today on the 100th-ish show. And with me are Skip and Adam of Obstructive View. How are you guys doing in this fine new year?
Well, I think I'm doing better than Jeff, who's not with us, because I rather enjoyed watching the Packers lose. I'm not sure he did.
Yeah, that's football season for sure. I guess we could start with that. Actually, I wanted to ask you guys if you partook in the college football playoffs, because it was 12-team playoff, and a lot of people seemed kind of displeased about it. What did you guys think? Because I thought the games were interesting in the previous round.
Buckeyes all the way! Yeah!
Wait, yeah. For real?
Yeah, because I think in the first round, all the top seeds won, and then in the second round, all the bye teams lost. So that was really strange. But
I've really liked the playoffs as a whole. I have not been in love with a lot of the commentary that I thought was ridiculous, but the opening round, I think it was exactly what it should be. You know, I've never thought that it should be like this. When it was four teams, they really felt like it had to be as best as they could put it together, the four best teams in that moment, like the four teams that the committee thought would most likely be able to take on all comers. And in when you have a 4-team tournament, that kind of makes sense, right? Because you are essentially saying, we want to know what team, if everybody played each other, who would come out on top. And since we can't have all those preliminary games, we want to take the teams that we feel, if they had been allowed to play each other as they are right now, who would be most likely to emerge from those previous rounds. So they, in some cases throughout the records, we had the case last year where Florida State had not lost, but that didn't qualify them. And that's been the problem with college football for a long time, is that it is possible in Division I, whatever the label for Division I is, any given year, you could go undefeated and not even qualify for the national championship. So when you are only narrowing it down to four teams, I think it makes sense to make those judgment calls based on gut feeling, or, oh yeah, your quarterback's hurt, and so you're not one of the best four teams anymore, whatever. When you expand it to 12, you give four teams a bye through the first round. So you won your conference champion, the top four ranked conference champions all get their bye. Okay, fine. Or they all get, you know, automatically in, however it works. You win your conference championship. If you're one of the Power Five conferences, you're in. Okay. Beyond that, you start to take on not necessarily the best 12 teams. You include teams that, well, maybe they're good. We don't know, because wins in college football don't tell us a lot. You know, you can win every game and maybe none of those wins were all that impressive. Losses tell us a little bit more. You lose. Okay, that gives us some frame of reference. You lost to one of the, lesser teams, and that gives us some context. So teams who haven't lost to enough bad teams or who haven't beaten enough really, really good teams, we need to see something from you. So you start to have teams like Indiana from a Big Ten that is like big 27,000 now, or an SMU from an ACC that, they weren't all that well tested, but we want to see a little bit more from you. Teams that haven't had those big regular season losses, let's see if maybe you belong. Give us a chance, let's give you a chance to prove it. And they had their chance on these bigger teams' home fields, which makes it very, very difficult to win. But if you were that good, here was your chance to prove that you belonged. They had their chance. They weren't able to overcome those home field disadvantages, and they were out, but they had their chance. The big name schools like Alabama or anybody from the power conferences who are on the verge of being left out. But if you have three losses, those three losses have told us you're not the best team in the country. We know that. Let's see who else we can, give a shot to see if maybe they belong here. And if you're in, you belong. That's it. You had your chance. If a team was that deserving, they would have been in. It shouldn't be that much of a controversial thing. So I really enjoyed all those extra teams involved in the tournament. And you have this tournament where whoever wins is going to win, was it 4 games or 5 games? 4 games?
Right.
Yeah. 4 college football postseason wins is pretty amazing.
Right.
With that field, if you've done it, if you've won 4 games, you've done it. You ran the table. That's crazy good. And even if you had a bye, and it's like, oh, I don't know if you deserve to have a bye because you're a Boise State or a Arizona State who, maybe got that easy in. You still got to win 3 games. So there's no easy road to a national championship in that setting. A lot of different things, a lot of new things. I thought it was fun. Maybe they'll adjust how seeding goes, but I liked it.
Yeah, I think they will probably figure out the seeding a little better. The one that was really, I guess, surprising to me was Oregon going down. But maybe in retrospect, I shouldn't be surprised. However, I think it was interesting how the primary round, the higher seeds got to play at their home stadium. But in the next round with the bye teams, they didn't get to play in their home stadiums. They had to play like in the traditional bowl system. So they didn't necessarily play in their home system, except for maybe Texas. Texas got to play very close to Texas because I think they were at Cowboy Stadium or something, right?
Yeah,
But
in the second round for them.
I
Yeah.
mean, Oregon got to play in the Rose Bowl, and I realize that Los Angeles isn't Eugene, but it's Oregon fans will travel.
Yeah,
So
they did travel, and it was just really weird. Like you'd think with the extra time, and even back then when you had just the national championship game, that team hadn't played for like a month since its conference championship. So you can't even use the long layoff as an excuse, right?
right.
I don't know. It's not an excuse, but it's definitely something, right? If you've played, if you had, if like Ohio State, and full disclosure, my mom was born a stone's throw from Columbus, so she's got Ohio State fandom in her blood. I grew up cheering for Ohio State, and at some point, I just dropped my college allegiances because I didn't go to a school that had a football team. And I realized it's a lot more fun to just follow college football than it is
Wait,
to have
wait,
a
wait.
severe rooting interest.
Wait, Adam, didn't you go to Purdue, or are you just assuming they didn't have a football team?
No, no, but if I had gone to Purdue, I could say that. No, I went to Moody Bible Institute in
Oh, okay.
Chicago, Illinois. We had an intramural football team, but yeah, that was far different. So yeah, college football is such a huge league that your chances of being happy at the end. And this was coming from someone who was an Ohio State fan, and like they were in the thick of it all the time. And it was like, this is just like stepping outside of it. It doesn't make sense to get all that, wrapped up in a college football team's hopes because there are too many competitors. It's just it's too much.
Which is why it's okay in the old days that, hey, you know what, we had a 10-2 season and we won our bowl game and that's a successful year. You know the thing, just to kind of pitch in on a few things. I agree with you, Adam. I thought the rationale behind the playoff, the way it's set up now, the way you explained it, I agree with that. I thought the first round did a really good job of explaining why it doesn't matter if you're Alabama and you got shut out, or if you're Iowa State and you didn't get included because SMU or I don't know, Indiana or whoever else people thought didn't belong were in there, because none of those questionable teams looked all that competitive. And then, Alabama lost their bowl game to Michigan anyway. So it's not like they were all that competitive to be in there. And so, just as you said, it's kind of the show me thing. The thing that I also appreciate these days is that now that college football is a professional league and that the players are all essentially free agents, then we can throw out all this discussion about whether they're student athletes and what the effect of expanded playoff on their college careers are. And so and maybe that doesn't track for some of the second team guys on a big team, but that's the reality these days. And so it makes sense to me to go to an expanded playoff, and I think it's been great. And I'm surprised, like you said, Ken, about Oregon not showing up in the first half of their game. But let's let this play through for a couple of years before we make massive changes to it and see what it looks like. I mean, 1 year is an experiment.
Yeah, I think generally the comeback attempts by a couple of the bye teams were pretty cool as well. So you know that they're talented. They just probably shouldn't have looked past their opponent or not come out as hot. But the fact that they adjusted was kind of interesting to me and very exciting too at the end. But yeah, too little, too late. Maybe don't go down 21 nothing in the first half next time, right?
Yeah,
But
and it all does come down to that old Steve Stone saying he used to break out all the time is it's not always who you play, it's when you play them. And when you're talking about guys who are in their late teens and or 20s, you can't always expect the utmost consistency across the board, So if when a team is peaking at the right time, sometimes it just works out for them, and that's kind of the fun thing about a playoff is in football. I think if you are truly that much more dominant than everybody else, it's not really going to matter who you play in any given round. The really great college football dynasty teams, they're able to win when they know it counts, when they know it matters. But in a year like this, in a system like this, where, like Skip said, the players are paid and the transfer portals make it a lot easier to establish parity, there's not going to be a team that just towers over everybody else. So it is going to be pretty competitive top to bottom. So this type of thing, can be pretty interesting. And yeah, I have some connection to IU and to SMU, just with people I know who are associated with the team. So it was fun to, to see them involved. But it's also pretty hilarious that A, IU lost to two teams this year, which is insane on its own. But those two teams are playing each other for the national championship. That just blows my mind. So, just crazy things like that happening. The longer this system goes on, the more interesting things like that will continue to happen every year. So, yeah,
Well,
it's been
and
fun.
IU also was a team that clearly benefited from a coach who understood how the portal worked and how to bring the transfer students in, and good for them, right? I mean, that's part of the landscape now, so you might as well take advantage of it. So, yep. Whether you
Just
like it or not, it's the rule.
convincing athletes to go to Bloomington, Indiana is quite a task, I would say,
Yeah, and to be
having
fair,
driven through it.
it wasn't like he brought in like, recruits from Alabama or Washington after their coach had left. He brought in guys from his school, which wasn't was it Division One? I
It was
like.
James Madison. Yeah, they had just moved up.
So
Okay,
they're
okay.
the FCS type teams rather than the FBS, but they were still at Division One, I think. James
Wow.
Madison was in the FCS playoff, weren't they?
Well, they no, they're part of the either the Sun Belt or Conference USA now. They moved
Oh,
up
okay. So they did
maybe
move
two
up
years
from
ago.
the other ones. Okay.
Yep.
That's fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a baseball podcast. Sorry, guys. But that was
Hey.
fun. There's an NFL playoff happening. Like, I think we could talk about that later. But I think a lot of people came to, I say a lot of people, ha ha ha, but they came to talk to us about the Chicago Cubs. So I thought maybe we can discuss the Kyle Tucker news, what the Cubs still have left to do. A bit about the Roki Sasaki sweepstakes, which I don't think the Cubs are winning, but who the hell knows anymore? And finally, a certain somebody is coming back to CubsCon. So how's that for a plan, guys?
I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it.
I think it's great. And the fact that we just spent 20 minutes talking about football seems totally appropriate, considering that since Kyle Tucker, the Cubs have done really nothing. And they haven't used any of that Cody Bellinger money that they dumped. So I think it's fair for us to spend a few minutes on something
As the
else.
spring gave way to summer, past the ivy colored dreams, toward the days that kept us yearning for tomorrow.
So let's go back to that Kyle Tucker that Skip just mentioned. The Cubs did, in fact, trade for Kyle Tucker. I think we talked about that last time, last year, actually, technically. But the arbitration deadline has passed. They had to exchange numbers because they could not come up with a plan, come up with an agreement. So at this time, I believe the Cubs have filed at 15 million. Kyle Tucker's camp has filed at 17.5. That's a $2.5 million gap. That's the largest in this year's arbitration class for those who haven't settled. So it's not really that much in the grand scheme of things for, a billionaire owner, but it might be for the Chicago Cubs and for precedent and for whatever free agent contract they sign next. So yeah, like your thoughts are welcome, gents.
I think the Cubs tend to be a what do they call it? Where
File
you
and trial.
file and trial, that's it. Yes. I think most of the teams have gone to that. Although I don't know if it's as strict when it's somebody that you just traded for. So, I mean, you've certainly had a lot less time to work out an agreement. So, it'd be nice if they work out an agreement, but I don't know that, these things, that they have long lasting effects on relationships in most cases anymore.
No, there's a. So the way I understand it is there is file and trial. They did that as of a few years ago. I think they took Ian Happ to arbitration and he ended up extending, but Can't in good conscience compare Ian Happ to a Kyle Tucker because they're just not the same level of player. However, that is something that happened, and they happen to be represented by the same agency. So the other thing that I'd like to point out is that Kyle Tucker himself was taken to arbitration by Houston. I think that was the first time he filed. He was also $2.5 million apart with Houston, and they won that time. He lost. So it's not without precedent for a Kyle Tucker to lose an arbitration. And also, I don't believe that the Cubs will be hard and fast with the filing trial because during the lockout season, which I think is partially helped by the fact that all the arbitration hearings were held in season after the lockout. So they had time to talk to Wilson Contreras and say, okay, fine, we'll compromise. And I haven't been able to confirm this, but somebody told me that Bruce Levine said, or is it Levine or Levine? I don't really care. Anyway, Bruce, the old guy who typos a lot on Twitter, he said that they are very likely to settle by the time Cubs convention rolls around. So this is kind of one of those things that does look embarrassing on the surface, but maybe it's not such a big deal after all, as you said.
Yeah, it's just something that doesn't look good, you know. The yay, we just signed this guy. It sure does make a whole lot more sense if we extend him and end up signing him to a big long contract. And that first chance you have to sit across the table from him and his agent, it's oh yeah, we're really far apart on how much we should pay you. You'd much rather have it be like, you know what? We should just sign an extension now. Screw free agency. Let's do a Maguire and go ahead and call this our new home. So, not that I was expecting that to happen, but to be all nickel and dimey for somebody that you just gave up a prospect and a couple of good major leaguers for who. The total of all their salaries is still less than what they were offering him. And I'm sure that's what they're saying is like, oh, we traded the total salary of everybody we traded for you was less than what we're offering. So it seems pretty obvious we're pretty generous at this point, but oh well.
Well, the Cubs are offering about what the projection was if you follow MLBTR, so.
Yeah, and a clarification, they're filing at 15. They didn't offer 15. So I think that's a leverage play because they're basically, if you think of the midpoint of 15 and 17.5 million is just above 16 million, that's where I think they'll settle, right? And I think the Cubs think that they are going to win the case if they file at 15 million more so than Kyle Tucker's camp would win at 17.5. And that's why they did it that way. So that's a leverage play to say, okay, if we take you to arbitration, you're getting 15, but if you settle now, you're getting 16 and change. That's what I'm thinking.
We shall see.
Yeah, but it's not going to matter in terms of whether or not Kyle Tucker is a Cub. He's going to be a Cub for up to 1 year. Like, that's guaranteed. That's assuming, again, that they don't like have to trade him or something, or nobody gets hurt. But yeah, that year is guaranteed. He's under contract. The only issue is how much he's getting paid. Now, go ahead.
Do you think the Cubs are really gonna, like, if they extended him, that they'd extend him for a $400 million contract over, I don't know, what would it be, 12 years? I just don't see the Cubs playing that game. I think that he's a 1 year player for us.
Yeah, so the way I thought about it, and I think we talked about this last time too, is when I looked at that trade package, I was like, wow, that's it. That's all you have to give up because you're talking about a perennial 5-win player and you gave up a flash in the pan prospect who could potentially like break through and do really well for Houston, but you won't know that for a few years. And then you have a broken Isak Paredes, who hopefully like finds himself on in the Crawford boxes, and then you have Hayden Wesneski, who has his own
I
set of
wouldn't call him
issues.
broken.
But the thing for me is I looked at that package and I was like, okay, you are giving that up for 1 year of a superstar. I'm totally okay with that. If you then use that year to show him how awesome Chicago is and how much fun he's going to have with this core of players that's coming up, you have a chance to convince him during that year to extend. And then you look at the way they approach like the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes that they didn't win, but they definitely had the money that would have been able to pay him. And that money was more than whatever you conceivably offer a Kyle Tucker next winter, right? So that money stayed, it's there. And all the other money that's coming off the books over the next couple of years before the CBA has to be renegotiated, that's room in the payroll for them to, keep a Kyle Tucker. So I don't think it's a monetary problem. It's more of a, is there a fit? Is there a desire? I feel like a lot of people say they wouldn't have done this if they didn't think there was a chance. But the way the trade went down for me, they're just guaranteeing him themselves that 1 year of production and 1 year to convince him to stay.
Yeah, I don't think you can convince a guy at his power free agent year, that really the chance, like what he's getting when you're coming off of your arbitration period and finally you're a free agent, that's a once in a career opportunity, unless you have some type of major resurgence a few years down the road, like a Kyle Schwarber did. Well, he was let go before arbitration was even through. So, you're not going to typically convince a guy to just stay because of the city. I mean, playing for the Cubs, I think, is kind of like visiting Paris. It's like it's an experience. All the players say you got to try it. You got to play at least 1 year for a team like the Cubs or the Dodgers or the Yankees, to see what that's like. But you stay for the money. You don't move to Paris just because you like it. Like the Cubs aura isn't going to be enough all on its own if you don't also pay according to what everybody else is going to. And I think Skip is right. They're probably not going to give him some kind of 12-year deal, which I don't know if he's to that level where he's commanding double digit years or 400 million, but he's definitely closer to that than like the Dansby Swanson contract. And I think the only way the Cubs would offer someone that type of package was if that was the explosive multiplier that you're adding to a roster full of prospects who hit at the same time, similar to what they had in 2015. So having a superstar that you're adding to a roster that is dynamite and cheap might make sense. But when it's kind of your only superstar on a roster that is okay and rather expensive, the timing's probably not great. So I guess all that to say, like, I don't want to say, oh, the Cubs are so stupid for not signing him to an extension now and doing everything in their power to, woo him. I just think it's a pretty good sign that the Cubs are probably not, all in on getting him for the long haul. It's a pretty good sign that he is a 1 year signing. If they do happen to offer it, get him as a free agent next off season, it will only be because they had one or two prospects who had fantastic years, and suddenly the competitive window for the rest of the roster looks really good. And building on that with a guy like Kyle Tucker makes it the type of thing that moves them from a playoff competitor to a World Series contender.
So what you're
Right now.
saying is we want Matt Shaw and PCA to be badass, and that'll convince the owners and Jed Hoyer, if he gets to stay, and Kyle Tucker, that we can keep the band together.
Yeah, or they might go, I don't know who else is available or how the, how the other prospects who might hit, there's always someone you're not expecting who, emerges as a possible dude, and that kind of thing could happen. But I think the main purpose for bringing Kyle Tucker in was to make sure the Cubs make the playoffs this year,
Right.
not to be the difference maker that sends them to the World Series.
Well, if he'd settle for an 8-year contract, I think the Cubs might play. If he wants a 12-year contract, I think he's a 1-year player for the Cubs, and the Cubs have nothing to lose by going to an arbitration hearing with him. And they may have already had those conversations, so they kind of have an idea. I sort of doubt that they have it all figured out at this point, but maybe it doesn't take that much. Maybe he knows exactly what he wants, and his agent's been able to explain that, and the Cubs sort of know where things stand too. So,
Yeah. And you
yes.
kind of want him to have the kind of year that gets him a 12-year deal,
Right.
right? Like that would be be for our short-term interest, that would be the best thing if he's an MVP candidate and his postseason numbers are outrageous next year. Like I would like that. That would be fantastic. It would probably mean the Cubs wouldn't sign him. But I'd be okay with it.
Right.
I think it'd be amazing if we had 11 guys on the team to hit 330 with 30 or more home runs. I'd totally be into that season. Yep.
That'd be fantastic. I was looking at the following offseason's free agent list, and so we can start with Vlad Jr. He just got like 28 million from the Blue Jays, who have been having trouble signing anybody. But that's a Canada problem, I think. After that, I think
Not after
again,
this year.
when they become state number 51.
oh man, okay. Yeah, just look.
we won't need to cross the border to play in Toronto by the time 2026 rolls around.
I can't wait for all of our federal taxing returns to be printed in both English and French.
Oh, we no, it'll be all English, you know that.
Now you've totally lost control over us.
Was just saying that, like, it's basically Vlad Jr. and Kyle Tucker as like superstar bats next year. You don't have Juan Soto; he's a Met for as long as he decides not to opt out. And then everybody else is just kind of there. You get good bats. Like, I think if Jock Peterson opts out and he does well, Kyle Schwarber is a free agent, but he's like I hit under 200, but I'll still get you 40 home runs kind of guy. So he'll piss off a lot of people, but he'll still give you production. So I feel like if the Cubs want a marquee free agent, they either shift that money towards like one of the pitchers, like a Dylan Cease, who finally is a free agent, or a Walker Buehler who suddenly like decided, oh yeah, like I should probably take this 1 year deal and really do well with it, etc. Or they sign either Vlad Jr. or Kyle Tucker. So I feel like there's a lot of money that the Cubs have, and they should use some of it. But whether or not they decide to use it on a Kyle Tucker, that's still up in the air. But for the time being, we have Kyle Tucker for a year. And to make this year really count, what else do the Cubs have to do, guys?
At the risk of repeating what I said a month ago, they need to sign a starting pitcher that's
There you
not
go.
Colin
Yeah.
Ray, and they need to beef up their bullpen.
Yeah. I think Colin Ray is a depth signing, and I don't know why it cost $5 million and why they needed to feel that way, but
Isn't he a
there's
country
some.
singer?
That's an excellent question. I don't know enough about country to tell you one way or the other. But He was a brewer for a little while after coming back from either Korea or Japan. And he was one of those pitchers that really frustrated you, that you wonder why such a thing would happen. Oh, because it's the Brewers and they have devil magic, right? So, but obviously there's some talent in there and he eats innings. So I think you can consider that this could be one of those 7D chess signings that will work out, especially since Craig Counsell has managed him before. So I really don't know one way or the other how it's gonna go, but I
But
think there's a method to the madness, and I just don't know what that is right now.
yeah, for the record, Callan Ray is a country singer. One of my songs that I really love to sing along to is called Little Rock. Great song, Callan Ray hit. It's a five war song, so maybe that's why the Cubs signed him.
Well, I mean, he was a Cub briefly in the past.
That is true. Yeah, I remember that.
I suspect, to me, he is a little bit better Javier Assad, and what it does, signing him, what that does is it makes it easier for the Cubs to trade Assad if they want to throw him into a package, for a like a full-time starting pitcher instead of a swing starting pitcher. So say, for instance, they want to swing a deal with San Diego for one of their starters, or if the Luis Castillo rumors are back on the table with Seattle or something, then you could throw Assad in, and these other teams that want a little bit of salary relief can have a starting pitcher at cheap, and Colin Ray's basically the same profile. And so the Cubs already have somebody to fill in behind that.
So right now, I think it's like it's Steele, Imanaga, and Tyone as your three fixtures in the rotation. After that, it's like really up in the air. Like a lot of these guys are either like a Nate Pearson, where they're saying, "Oh, you have a chance to start." You have swingman like Javier Assad, as you said. You have Colin Ray. You have Killian. You have Matthew
Well,
Boyd, who they just
right.
signed. So it's like a lot of mix and match type pieces that could be a full-time starter, or they could piggyback them, or they could be an opener, or blah, blah, blah. It gives them a lot of options, but they're not exactly like world beaters, you know? You're just like, well, it could work. And I hope it does work, but you're not giving yourself as much confidence as you otherwise could be.
Yeah, and I feel like the Cubs in general seem to take the let's build a team that can at least tread water for the first half of the season, and maybe we'll overachieve, and then we can really add after the break, you know. And I can see them maybe reaching for some, you know, some pitcher on some non-contender, which, you know, the list of the non-contenders is ever shorter as the postseason slots have expanded, but there's still that possibility that they can try and add a starter closer to the trade deadline to really get competitive for the final push and the postseason, and deal some of those prospects that either don't hit this year, or that they're just holding on to as bargaining chips for mid-season upgrades. So that's I feel like if the Cubs have enough quantity arms that they think they can manage the rotation for the first half of the year, then, you know, they're not going to reach too far for a rotation upgrade at the start of the season. But if things go well and they find themselves competitive, and if they find the division not as competitive, I can see them making a deal that would improve them for this year and possibly, you know, the next season as well, by trading some prospects to a team that, you know, has lost their playoff hopes come July.
So if I do a conspiracy theory, one that First of all, I think they signed a gentleman who was from Tread, which is kind of like Driveline. And one of the things that I hope they do, in addition to unlocking more potential from the pitchers and showing them how to, throw better pitches, is keeping arms healthy. And for the most part, I think the Cubs had one of the more healthy rotations in the league. So that was kind of encouraging. If they can do that while the Dodgers continue to break every single arm that they have, including like now Blake Snell and probably Roky Sasaki soon, then they could potentially compete that way because of attrition. And that's not me hoping that everybody else like gets injured, because that's terrible and evil. But it seems like something that's happening to the Dodgers a lot. Like you see another good arm, and then suddenly they have to have Tommy John surgery, or something weird happens, and then that happened to Yamamoto, and he was able to come back in the postseason and pitch really well. So that was cool. But that didn't happen so much for Glasnow, who I think had to have Tommy John surgery again. So that's just kind of like a conspiracy theory thing, is let's get, like you said, Adam, as much quantity of pitching as possible so that we have depth. We have reasonably consistent depth that can get us through. And then let's see what we can do at the half point of the season and upgrade. I don't necessarily like that idea, but it's very hard to just build 90-win teams in this current economic environment for baseball, right?
You just saved $21 million or $25 million or whatever it is from Cody Bellinger.
Right.
Spend it.
They should spend it.
Spend it. Spend it on a pitcher. That's why you save the money. Or maybe you just save the money to save the money for no reason, which is what I was hinting at the last time. It's just ridiculous that they have, they dumped Cody Bellinger, who's a good offensive player who they could have worked into the rotation, not the pitching rotation, but the hitting rotation, and had a stronger, deeper team. They dumped his salary. If you don't spend that, then it's just a salary dump. And to me, that shows a lack of commitment on ownership at this point. But I'm willing to wait to see how the offseason plays out. But if it plays out without signing, a decent starting pitcher or trading for a decent starting pitcher, then, or maybe a shutdown closer, then, which, I really don't expect, then it's just a salary dump. And it says to me that the Cubs are more interested in the money than they are on winning.
That could partially be true, but if you look at the signings or the transactions, or actually lack thereof, a lot of those shutdown closers and a lot of the pretty interesting starting pitcher options are still out there. So they are out there for the taking. They just have to take it. And that brings us to Roky Sasaki, because we are getting up to the international signing period and also his posting deadline. Basically, like I think on or around January 23rd, which is his posting deadline, you'll find out, first of all, who gets to develop Roky Sasaki as an MLB player. And also you'll see a flurry of trades and or signings, because everybody who lost out will want their like plan B pitcher. So I think that's what's holding things back, is not just like people saying, I don't want a pitcher. It's like, let's see which team he goes to first, and then we'll get our pitcher.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. I do want to make a prediction, regardless of where he goes, that if he does sign with an MLB team, he's going to win Rookie of the Year.
Oh,
Thank you.
I mean, I understand that in some sense, except for the economics is different with him because you can't pay him any more than your international free agency bonus pool.
Right, but
So,
he still takes up a roster spot. That's the thing. So you.
yeah, it's a supply and demand issue versus a market setting salary issue. So it's just finding out who has the Sasaki supply that they were wanting and who just has demand for a pitcher that's not him.
And
But
it's
the
not just the roster spot, it's the way he fits into that current rotation. So if you have a Sasaki, why am I getting the other guy except to bump my projected former number five starter to the bullpen or to another team or something like that? So it changes a lot of dynamics for that team that gets them. And then they could decide, okay, I'm only paying this guy like a couple million dollars in the bonus, and that doesn't count against my luxury tax because now he's making league minimum, blah, 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 because I can't pay him more because Rob Manfred will yell at me, right? But now I can repurpose this 20 plus million dollars that I didn't spend on that caliber of pitcher on another pitcher or another hitter or whatever. So that does change their plans a little bit. They need to know how they're going to spend that money, even if they have the money now. I don't know who's getting Sasaki yet. We're going to wait it out and then we'll figure it out. That's what I think is going on.
Yeah, but I mean, we just listed the Cubs starting rotation. Unless you're really firm with Matthew Boyd as a strong number four or better, they've got two openings that they can put in. So they don't need to wait. They can sign their starting pitcher and they can get Roki Sasaki.
Yeah. So the other side of that coin is the pitchers are trying to see where he goes and then which teams are going to be desperate for their services. So they're not going to sign early just to sign early unless you're going to overpay. And I have no idea what an overpay is in this market. So that's the only thing. Like, again, that is being dictated by the pace at which this Roki sweepstakes is going out. And before we go on too much, he's a Dodger, right? There's like 99% chance that that's going to happen.
I guess
I
so.
mean,
seems to me like he's going to be the next member of the Grand Prairie High School Dodgers, and they'll ride him hard, and he'll have an arm injury, and he'll fall in just like all the other Dodgers. Yep.
Yeah, he might have torn his rotator cuff just doing the handshake deal with the Dodgers. So maybe he changed his mind, like walked away from that meeting a little sore and was like, I don't know. I don't know. I'm sore already. Need to consult a surgeon. Maybe I should rethink my career choices. Who can say?
So his agent came out and said that market size, whether if it was a big market team or whatever, had no bearing on his on where he was going to end up. Does anybody believe that?
Well, he did visit San Diego today, or like very recently. So, depending on who you talk to, San Diego can be a big city with a big market, or they could be a tiny market because at least two football teams or major sports teams have left San Diego over the past decade. So, it's like San Diego does have Yu Darvish, and Yu Darvish did sell, say, on the Cubs, so good for him. Maybe Roki doesn't like San Diego, and Yu Darvish says, "Yeah, you should try the Cubs instead," because I don't think Yu necessarily likes the Dodgers anymore, anyway.
If he's visiting San Diego now and then decides he'd rather be in Chicago, God bless him. But that would be a crazy set of circumstances.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, a few hundred miles north, the place is on fire, and it's a very bad situation. So, if anything, that could be a deterrent to wanting to be in Los Angeles. But I don't know how the guy thinks. Like, I moved away from California just to avoid wildfires and super expensive housing and also earthquakes. But people like California because it's pretty. And maybe he just ignores the fact that, that chunk of the state is on fire.
Yeah, who knows? But we shall see. We shall
Mean,
see.
they could invite him to Cubs convention. That's before the deadline.
Why not? Yeah, something tells me that is not the way to convince a player to sign with the Cubs is to parade him around the particular brand of fans who shows up to Cubs convention. Like, I think it's more the selling on that the day of game, the crowd going wild when there's 40,000 of them, not when there's however many people show up at CubsCon.
On the other hand, this year, he can see, how crazy, 3,000 people are for a guy that's been out of baseball for 15 years, even with some questionable history and how much he's loved. And he can say, wow, even for Sammy Sosa, they love him that much this long after he's been gone.
I don't speak for all Cubs fans, though, but I think most of them will agree with me. Sammy Sosa is awesome.
I think the Cubs convention folks are going to be ecstatic that Sammy Sosa's back, and that's a good thing.
I think a lot of people were just waiting for an excuse to be okay with it, and it's probably half and half. Probably half of the fans at CubsCon are just waiting for Ricketts to say it's okay to cheer for Sosa. The other half, doesn't care that much about him. But I think it's a good thing that everybody got over it. It was a joke that the owner of what is it, a $2 billion franchise that frankly wouldn't be a $2 billion franchise without Sammy Sosa.
I think it's up to 4.3 or something now. It's a lot.
Goodness. Yeah,
This is
it's
why billionaires should be abolished, but that's a different story altogether.
yeah, here's all it's my favorite thing is my favorite part, a little detail about going to the Kerry Wood 20 strikeout game was that that ticket for a bleacher seat cost me $6. That is like the tax you pay on a bleacher ticket now. And it was really 98 was the last year that bleacher seats would ever be affordable. And that was it was a bargain day, so it wasn't like they were all $6. But 1998, the home run derby, the home run race to catch Ruth, that summer was the thing that turned bleacher seats from being kind of a cool niche thing to being a luxury premium ticket in the stadium. And all of the property behind it, the value of the apartments and the rooftops across the street, that skyrocketed as well because it was in the national spotlight and that became like a premium venue. It was kind of a cool thing and it became a can't miss part of the Wrigley experience. And so the value of a ticket to Wrigley, the value of a bleacher ticket, the value of the rooftops and the property and the value of the franchise. The Kerry Wood game was one game, and people really loved Kerry Wood, but Sammy Sosa put the bleachers on the national, international map. And that's what completely changed the economy of not just Wrigley, and the Wrigley experience, but Major League Baseball as a whole. Let's be honest, baseball was struggling in that race. And no matter how performance enhanced it was, there wasn't a single owner or a single front office exec, and frankly, a single baseball writer who didn't want that to happen and didn't profit off of that happening. Being a baseball writer in America in the mid-90s and mid to late 90s got to a point where it sucked. And so for those, for the owners or any media members to act affronted by the steroid users or accused steroid users, and particularly Sammy Sosa, who brought such flair and panache to that race, to act all high and mighty when it's the reason they have jobs and the reason they have, billions of dollars of value in their baseball teams, is unconscionable, pathetic, drives me nuts. So, yeah, welcome back, Sammy. Sorry it took so long.
Yeah, I do like that. It's basically the houses, as in the rooftops and the bleachers that Sammy built for
Yeah.
that. So it's really nice.
I just
Never
like to
thought of that.
remind both of our listeners out there that
Yes.
it's Hall of Fame voting season. In case you weren't aware of that, and Adam's his little monologue there is aimed perhaps intentionally or perhaps not at some of those voters.
I think Sammy fell off the
Yeah.
ballot last year or the year before, unfortunately.
Yes, he
Yeah,
did.
he's done.
But the voters haven't changed that much since then. So.
Yeah, a few younger ones have snuck in. So I think, like, eventually the electorate will change such that they'll vote different guys in. But unfortunately, the ones that we personally grew up with will have to rely on the veterans committees, and I think those guys are a little less forgiving than the writers are. So we'll
They
see.
all just need to get over it. Like, what, however many rounds it goes, at some point they just got to acknowledge those guys were a part of saving baseball, and the sport as a whole said, okay, this is what we're gonna do.
Build a new wing of the Hall of Fame that looks like a pillbox or a syringe and just put all their plaques in it.
Yeah. It's it is what it is, but it was part of baseball. The idea that it was like some back alley fringe group of baseball people who wanted it to happen. I think there's a special place for the guys who abstained and just did their thing and competed throughout. I do think they deserve special recognition for that, but it was the sport decided to do it, to blackball a few people, just to appease our horror at how awful it was. It's time to move on. Time to move on.
Agreed.
And
Did
by
you
far not the worst thing that baseball's ever done.
Yeah, do you you guys remember the Sammy Sosa apology statement, huh? Did you guys think it was as amusing as I did? This was basically like, yeah, I guess I did stuff, but I didn't say the S word out loud.
I mean, it got
Yeah.
the job done, right?
Yeah. And Tom was
Yeah,
like,
it
yeah,
took like what, 5 minutes?
okay,
He
I guess.
was invited to Cubs Con within the half hour.
Yeah,
So
that was
yeah,
great.
it worked. But I did, yeah, I did like that it was yeah, I did some things, I took some things to recover from injury or whatever, and nobody's perfect, but not doing a whole lot of self-flagellation, which is totally fine by my standards. And I like that nobody really seemed to put up the, call the apology police to make sure that he checked all the boxes. It was just like, okay, that's close enough to an apology. Let's move on and forget about it. So, yeah, I think that was cool.
Well,
By this time, we all know what he was apologizing for, right? I mean, it's not like we think that he was apologizing for getting in a car accident. So,
well, at least it
yeah, I
was a
think
DUI or something.
it was the nature of like how much of a role did performance enhancers play in his improvement that he's not willing to say it was a, it was a big part. So that's when people say it was to recover from injuries, the nature of bodybuilding and strength training is essentially you're injuring yourself through weight training and steroids and similar things allow you to recover from them and to sustain those injuries in a way that you come back stronger quicker. And when you can get stronger and more powerful and make your swing faster and cut down the reaction time you need in order to hit a baseball, that's pretty important. And when you do it as a pitcher, for however they break that into their training, it just makes you an effective, more effective strength trainer on some level, especially if you have professional guidance in doing that, So yeah, I think there are obviously limits to what should be allowed, but in the sense of the morality of it all, exalting any one group over another or sending anybody too far down the trash chute, that's where it gets too much for me.
Think when he became a bigger boy, he didn't steal as many bases. Like he used to fly all over the place. He stole a lot of bases in his younger days, but that kind of went by the wayside once he started hitting, 60 plus homers every year.
Yeah. And I guess my point before I launched into, yet another diatribe was you can truthfully say that you took performance enhancers to help you recover from injury, and that essentially, while it can be true in, the according to the letter of what you're saying, the spirit of it could be just, yeah, I use steroids and it may be, help me work out and get stronger. Like, yes, you are recovering from injury. So that is what it did. But when you just roid up like any other person, that's essentially what they're doing too. So, we're never going to know exactly what happened. So that's just kind of the way it's going to be left.
Well, welcome back, Sammy Sosa. And I guess, the football playoffs are over for today. There isn't a Monday night game because they had to move it to, or was it always a Monday night game? They
It was always a
basically,
Monday night game.
they had to move it out of LA though because the Rams were hosting. But LA is obviously on fire, and we hope everybody will be okay. But they're in Arizona for tomorrow next game. Anyway. Yeah, the football players are over. We have our first official quote upset, even though the Washington Commanders have a better record than Tampa Bay. I guess Tampa Bay got to host because they won the South, and the South really, really sucked this year, huh?
That's right. But they
Yeah, they
only
had for a
won
little
by
while.
like whatever the distance of the football clanking off the goalpost was.
Yeah, and it can only be so much of an upset, yeah, when the division champion has fewer wins than the wild card team, so.
So I'm good with that win because it means Washington goes to Detroit, and I don't really feel like watching Detroit play Minnesota again so quickly. I'd much rather that wait for another week or two.
Yeah, that'll be fun. But yeah, I guess the football playoffs have been generally kind of predictable, which makes sense in a way. Like you expect the home team to win most of the time for professional football. For college football, I guess it was a little bit more. What's the word? It's more chaotic in that. But yeah, the teams that we thought would win in the NFL did win, and yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and just to add another layer to that home field advantage for college, the colder it gets, the more being a cold weather team benefits in that home field advantage. So, that was another thing about playing those opening round home field games is you can't really expect to do that and have it be as entertaining and high flying a game as you do in all those, warm bowl stadiums. So that's one of the reasons why I don't expect them to add another round of home field games. Just because A, it doesn't allow the second round teams to really prepare unless all those bye teams, get their home games. But also if it's in a, if Michigan is hosting a game in early January, nobody really wants to see that happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been a fun sports winter. I kind of wish I had seen more of like the Dominican Winter League or anything like that. But we are a week away from Cubs convention, and hopefully some more transactions happen so we don't feel kind of meh about the offseason despite getting like a really good power bat who could become an MVP for the Cup. So, yeah, for now, I want to thank you guys for hanging out with me. You can find us at obstructiveview.net. And I got to talk to Jeff about like what we're doing with that place because I think some things on the back end are breaking and got to fix it. But yeah, thanks to Rich Deanna for a theme song, Randall Sanders for the final outcall, and for you gentlemen for joining us, for Adam for hosting with your awesome Zoom powers. And yeah, that's it for us. Any final thoughts, gents?
Yeah, go Buckeyes for real. And go Cubs.
Okay. So
Go Cubs!
no Notre Dame here. Definitely Buckeyes.
No. Yeah,
Okay.
I will say I'm a little more friendly toward the Irish than I used to be ever since Marcus Freeman took over. I call it one of the greatest face turns in college football history, Notre Dame going from the despised school to the, oh, well, actually with Marcus Freeman, it's kind of a fun and inspiring story. So sure, I'll jump on board.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks guys, and yeah, we'll see what happens with the Cubs. Go Cubs.
Go Cubs.
Go Cubs.
It was more than just a game.